Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, listeners. Did you know that Mack Weldon has smart design, premium fabrics, and a simple shopping experience? Their underwear is definitely better than whatever you're currently wearing.
Disagree, Matt. You know why? Because I'm currently wearing Mack Weldon underwear. And how can you be better than what it is?
That's right.
I think of Mack Weldon as the James Bond of underwear. Because in addition to looking and feeling great, all Mack Weldon products are crafted with natural fibers that have built-in performance capabilities, so they work hard too. This is James Bond of underwear. Think about it.
That's right. They even have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means, like James Bond, they eliminate. What do they eliminate? They have a license to kill odor.
All that, and they're shipped right to your door in an Aston Martin. Probably not an Aston Martin.
If you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked. That'd be a good James Bond title. No questions
asked. Oh, I like that. That'd be a great James Bond title. You know, I want to talk a little bit about my, I have Mack Weldon. Not only do I have Mack Weldon underwear, Matt, but I have a couple of Mack Weldon polos.
I've got the whole Mack Weldon collection at this point, and I love all of it.
It's great. The Mack Weldon, baby blue polo. If you want to feel like you're in Casino Royale, I can recommend no better way to do that than getting a baby blue polo from the good folks at Mack Weldon. And you know what? If you're like, well, what's in it for me? Well, I'll tell you what's in it for you. You can get 20% off your purchase right now if you go to MackWeldon.com and use the promo code BONDING.
And now, let's get to the show.
Matt and James Bonding Podcast.
Myra Gorley.
It's the James Bonding Podcast with Matthews, Myra, and Gorley. Matthews, Gorley, and Myra.
Cool. Hey, everybody, welcome to the James Bonding Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I am Matt as well.
We are here with a special in-betweener for you guys.
That's right. It's another Saturday morning here after I had another long night out. That marks the only two long night outs that I've had in probably the past 10 years.
Did you really go out again?
Yeah. I went to one of those personal karaoke booths. And let me tell you,
that's a night.
I dug into Skyfall.
Who was there? Any friends of the pod?
Well, Amanda, my wife.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Maybe. I just want to know if there's anybody else there who could like appreciate your digging in on it.
I think they would be kind in giving me more credit than I deserved because it wasn't my best work.
Well, Matt, I'm glad you rallied and you were able to be here today in your own home office. While I am in New York, it's the last of the bunch that we have to do apart, and quite frankly, I'm excited about it.
That's right. Maybe now we can finally get to some of these off-brand films.
The world is our oyster, my friend.
And
once I'm on hiatus, it is never enough. The world is never enough. Speaking of the world is not enough, Matt, today we decided to tackle something a little different. It's not that different because it is a sort of a ranking, if you will.
I will.
You will, and they will. We are talking about all of the directors of the James Bond franchise. Produced, everybody.
11 total of the official directors.
I was hoping there'd be 10 just to make it easy to have it, or just
top
clean.
10.
Yeah.
Well, we could do top 10 with honorable mention for number 11.
Top 10 with the single elimination round.
But that is pretty incredible. There's 24 films and 11 directors. So that's an average of what, like 2 point something per director?
Yeah. I mean, what throws it off a bit is these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 one-time directors.
Yeah, 4 of them Brosnan directors.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they gave him no consistency. They really set him up for failure, Matt.
Or did he just ruin these men where they couldn't take it anymore?
Disagree. You know what it was? There was like some people were like, I can't direct these movies. There's no room for me on the stage with Desmond Llewellyn's hands. So... you know what? I'll do it once, and that's it.
Well, let's recap who these directors are in the order that they appeared. First of all, starting, of course, with Terrence Young.
Yeah.
Who directed Dr. No and From Russia with Love, then came back for Thunderball.
Mm-hmm.
Then
took a turn.
For Goldfinger, we had Guy Hamilton, who also went on to do Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun. Am I missing any for him?
Nope, that's it.
And then,
By the way, we'll say that about Guy Hamilton. Maybe we'll talk to it about it when we get to it. Let's list it.
Then Lewis Gilbert, who did You Only Live Twice, The Spy Who Loved Me, and Moonraker.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's Peter Hunt, who the one-time director who did On Her Majesty's Secret Service, longtime editor.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have, I'm doing all of this by mind. Then we have John Glenn, who did For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, The Living Daylights, and License to Kill. Right? Then Martin Campbell for GoldenEye and Casino Royale. Then is it Roger Spottiswood? I think it's Spottiswood.
Yeah.
Who did Tomorrow Never Dies. Time, yeah. I mean, The World Is Not Enough, right? No, Tomorrow Never Dies. Then Michael Apted did The World Is Not Enough.
Yes.
And then Lee Tamahate.
Yeah.
We've been schooled on how to pronounce this name.
So much so that we didn't want to mess it up, so I went and watched a video of him being introduced at a New Zealand Film Commission conference. So if we are pronouncing it wrong now, quite frankly, we're still sorry.
I guess. And then Mark Forster for Quantum of Solace. And then here's another one that I've been schooled on for pronunciation. Do you say Sam Mendes or Sam Mendes?
I say Mendes.
Mendes.
So I say it wrong, apparently. Go ahead. What is it, Matt?
I don't know.
I thought you got schooled on it.
I did, but it was so long ago. And frankly, I don't get into those too heavily. But he's
Sammy
our last.
M.
Yeah, Sam Mendes. Sam Mendes, I think, is what it is. I don't know. You know what? Bear with us.
Yeah. Listen, I think everybody's just excited to be a part of this conversation and tell us everything they think.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, so, Matt, it's interesting here that we have this list in front of us. I have also pulled up a list of adjusted box office for inflation.
Ooh, great idea.
You're welcome. So I think we can also...
Well, I never thanked you. I just said it was a great idea.
You're welcome. And thank you. So it'll be interesting to see some surprising numbers on this box office updated for inflation.
So is it box office per director?
Well, Matt, I would have to do math for that kind of a thing, but it is box office per movie. I will say this. I will say number one on the list of the most domestic is, you're not going to guess it.
Most?
That's a challenge.
Not global, domestic.
This is domestic United States. So, for instance, Skyfall made $304 million domestically.
And that's not number one?
No. It's not. It's number three.
Is it Die Another Day?
No.
Casino Royale?
We'll get to this. You're not even close.
Well, then I don't know what to say.
But yeah, so it's time. We're gonna go through each director, ranking them from top to bottom, or rather bottom to top. Yeah, and we'll get into it. Matt, let's just jump right in. I feel like you're number one. I just have a feeling on your number one, and quite frankly, I'm not going to agree with it. But
wait, you're talking about my number 11.
Your number 11. I'm sorry.
I think our number and our 11 and our number ones are probably the same.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
My number 11 is Lee Tamahate.
Oh, you did it. I can't believe you did that. I was so expecting Roger.
I know, but I mean, I do think that even though I enjoy watching Die Another Day more than Tomorrow Never Dies, just because it's so batshit crazy, I do think it's pretty poorly directed. I mean, it's bonkers. I'm sure a lot of it was probably mandated by the time it was done, and maybe the producers saying they want to kind of ramp up things, like literally with the speed.
Literally ramp it up.
I bet he had quite a hand to play in that. I mean, the sense I get from him is he's got a flair and personal style that reflects his directing, and it maybe is a
I will say the video I watched of him, he was in a fur coat, and I was like, you know what? That's a fucking director.
Was this when they were shooting the ice castle scene?
No. This was recently.
In Palm Springs.
In a building near a train station.
Okay.
I know that because the train went by and it was very funny.
What are your thoughts on Lee Tamahate?
Well, listen, I this is not to take away from his body of work outside of the James Bond franchise now. I have to say, we're rating all of these people on their performance with the franchise we love so much.
Yes, because he was renowned for his,
Once Were Warriors?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, that being said, I have to agree with Matt. Die Another Day is so batshit. He didn't get a chance to come back and do anything else, so it is what it is. That being said, there are some nice shots in the movie.
What?
Not really. Are there any nice shots? I'm trying to think right now. Visually,
I like the car chase on the ice. Like, that's done well. But part of me thinks that was maybe a second unit director too.
But also, I think the part of that's not done well because of the speed ramping that is so happens so much in that particular instance.
Now, is that a post-production thing, or do you think they actually set up those Matrix cameras, those 360 cameras?
To do the speed ramps?
Yeah, but don't they do... I guess they don't do that, like...
rotating situation, thank God.
I remember this in my mind, that everything freezes and Neo jumps out of that BMW. And
classic Neo. That really, for me... The fact that I can't think of anything good. The sword fight, I like the direction of the sword fight that happens inside the fencing club.
But you know what we're also talking about is like tone and what he's doing with the actors. And I think he's not, I think that was one of the considerations I put into some of the work here. And that's why, like, there might be some slight surprises on my list. In terms of how the director works with the actors and how believable performances he gets. And I mean, the acting in this film is definitely on par with the visuals in that it's all just on cocaine.
it's on that snowy Arctic powder.
What do you think it would be like if Lee Tamahate had gone on to direct Casino Royale?
That's an insane question. I don't know.
Wouldn't that be amazing? I would love to see that.
I honestly have no clue. That's crazy to even think about.
Yeah.
I don't even know. It's hard to think about that movie done by anybody but Martin Campbell because it's so well done.
Right.
Anyway, I'm sure we're going to get to that very shortly.
Yeah.
Not very shortly, actually. It's going to be a while. Okay, so Matt, we had the same number 11 on this list.
Yeah.
It's time to talk about the number 10, and since you went ahead with your 11, I'll swing through with my fancy-dancy number 10. It is, ladies and gentlemen, Michael Apt did.
Mm.
The world is not enough.
And we'll do that thing where we won't talk about it.
Yes.
Until, okay.
So, Matt, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is Roger Spottiswoode.
Oh, that's interesting.
Roger Spott.
I talked about him for a while.
Spot his wood.
Spottiswoode. All right. So that is out of the way. Number 9 on my list, Matt. This might surprise you.
Hmm.
All right.
Okay.
I just want to throw this out there before I say the following. Lewis Gilbert.
Not altogether surprising.
Okay. Okay.
You know what? Oh, I'm torn about that myself. I'm struggling with where to put him in this list, but I don't have to decide that right away.
No, you don't.
Number 9 for me.
Yeah.
Michael Apted.
What? We're going to talk about Michael Apted. The
right.
world is not enough. Bing, 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 bing. All right, let's
he's
talk
number
about this
9
movie.
For me because I can't think of anything either way. You know, both he and Roger Spottiswoode is kind of that way to me where it's just mm-hmm. like, okay, I guess. The film got finished.
It did. And it's interesting. I haven't watched The World Is Not Enough since the last time you and I watched it for the earlier version of the James Bonding podcast.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to revisit now, but just
Me
going
too.
Back in my head of the film, well, he gets good performances. I like Robbie Coltrane's performance in it.
Yeah.
I like, you know, it's some over-the-top Brosnan-isms.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a, I think, you know, what's interesting about that movie is Judi Dench has the most to do
mm-hmm.
in that movie to that point. You know what I mean? She has more to do in that than she actually does in Casino Royale,
right.
Quantum of Solace, Diner of the Day.
Yeah.
It's not really till we get to Skyfall that we see another performance from her like that.
Right.
Where she's actually doing... She's actually in more than two scenes and involved in the plot. And in that movie, she is woven throughout the story. So,
also, you got two villains that kind of have actual souls. See, that's why I'd put him above Spottiswoode, because Carver's going nuts in that movie. But it's just kind of a cartoon performance. And I think Renard and what's her name, Elektra, they've got some
yeah.
depth to their character. This is a movie. I actually think this Brosnan's probably my second favorite because I could see where this one almost made it. You know, if you take Denise Richards out and maybe scale back some of the goofiness in the plot a little bit, there's
yeah.
something here. I'm actually looking forward to seeing this one again.
Yeah, it is also, there's a lot of, it's Desmond Llewellyn's last scene.
Yeah.
So it will be interesting to revisit his hands.
That's
and
right.
See how big they got.
And
maybe
it's got that
shrinking.
Brosnan suit that you love so much.
Oh, it has a linen suit with a blue shirt that is just the bee's knees.
It is pretty good. Do you have that? I forget.
No, there were a couple times where I almost purchased one and then realized I do not have the build of Pierce Brosnan.
Well,
and
who
therefore
does?
It would look ridiculous on me. So I've held off. But you know what? Maybe a couple summers from now, Matt, you and I on a beach and I'm wearing that suit and you fall into the ocean and I have to save you. So I'm going to dive. What I'll do actually is I'll go find the highest point nearby. So I hope you can tread water for a little bit.
Sure. That sounds... I'm into this.
Yeah. So, I mean, not an incapable director. How much of a performance can you get out of Denise Richards in that role, really, is the question.
Right. But then part of directing too is casting, and this is where I really wonder, like, how much the producers are saying it's got to be this person or the director. I like, they always seem to collaborate pretty well on these movies.
I think to my knowledge, I or rather not to my knowledge, but to my life's thought, I've always thought it was the producers on these movies, more so than anything the director would say.
He's also an interesting choice for a director because isn't he known for that series of documentary films, the Up series, where he follows children from a young age all the way into adulthood? Seven
like
Up,
the and, Seven Up, and all that shit. Yeah.
What I else mean, did he do yes, as is. Like narrative films?
I'll tell you right now.
Please do.
Enigma.
What's that? Oh, the recent one? The machine?
The 2001 one, not the Enigma machine. All right, here we go. Ready? A lot of docs. He did, he's done a couple episodes of recently, a lot of Ray Donovan and Masters of Sex.
Oh.
And let's see, I'm going to go back. Back. 28 up. Play for today. ITV Playhouse. That's a.
Well.
Yeah, I mean, really, just a director of documentary up until recently where he's started to get more into television.
Okay.
So.
Well, Matt, what's your number eight?
Let's go back to the list here. Oh, boy. It is interesting how these directors start to. We're going to get to a block in a second that's like, oh boy.
Yeah, like, how do you put one above the other?
Yeah.
Have you listened to Throwing Shade on Earwolf? It's a hilarious podcast hosted by Aaron Gibson and Brian Safi who deliver fresh takes on pop culture, women's rights, and LGBT rights.
And now they have a brand new bonus show exclusively on Stitcher Premium called Throwing Shade. Deeper Shade of Shade.
A deeper shade of shade. Oh. In each episode, Brian and Aaron put a twist on artistic starter cards from 1975 by asking hard-hitting questions like, would you clone yourself? And can you name a real housewife?
The first bonus episode has the one and only Paul F. Tompkins as a guest.
They get deep and talk about being interrupted during a dance, Popeye's anatomy, and inflatable snakes.
Listen to Throwing Shade, Deeper Shade of Shade, exclusively on Stitcher Premium.
For a free month of Stitcher Premium, go to stitcherpremium.com/shade and use promo code BOND. There, you can also find all kinds of other materials.
Even like, our live episode, Matt Gourley.
That's right. It's out now on Stitcher Premium. Use promo code BOND at stitcherpremium.com/shade.
This is maybe going to surprise everyone listening to this podcast, but my number nine, right?
Eight.
My number eight is... Mark Forster.
We can't pronounce these directors' last names to save our lives.
And that is no...
Why is that a surprise?
It's not an easy slide in for there, because I think Quantum Solace is visually one of the
save
best James
it
Bond
for the
movies.
Discussion. But I don't think people would be surprised to hear that one's lower, considering that film's troubled history. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, then let's discuss when we need to. Matt,
okay.
What's your next?
My number eight is a journeyman director and someone I like very much. I like his films very much, but we'll talk about it when we get to it. But John Glenn.
Matt, that's so interesting because that was my flip-flop. I was flip-flopping between Forrester and John Glenn.
Well, then let me just say that my number seven is Mark Forster. So we'll talk John Glenn, then we'll talk Mark Forster.
Wow.
Wow.
What a treat.
Wow.
I mean, really the only thing that saved John Glenn from utter demise for me was his real light touch with View to a Kill.
It's weird. I put him low on the list, but I happen to really like his films. I guess there's just nothing very special about them. They're just good, like, jobber Bond films and... I don't know. Like, he's just right in the pocket with Roger Moore.
He's certainly an actor. Is my wife showering? Yes, she is. This is crazy.
You're in a hotel room and your wife is there and she's showering right now.
She's
podcasting.
This is crazy. Like, it's like 1 foot away. She knew I had to podcast today. I don't know why she didn't do this earlier.
Well, this is very James Bond.
Oh boy. Should I go in there?
A water pistol.
apologize for the audio, everybody. In fact, I'm just going to like tweak this down just a little bit. Hopefully you just get less ambient. All right. Okay, so yeah, we're talking about
John Glenn.
John Glenn. Okay, so let's list the John Glenn movies. It's For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, right. A View to a Kill, Living Daylights, and License to Kill.
Right.
Now, of those movies, I think that you and I genuinely really enjoy watching three of them. Octopussy, View to a Kill, and Living Daylights.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Is that fair? Is that fair to say?
That's fair.
And the body of work wise, it's five movies.
I'm looking at him too because this is really all he did.
I know.
He did other films beforehand, but he did his... Wait, hold on. I'm looking at editor. Mm-hmm. Let me look at director. He did something called The Point Men, Space Precinct, Christopher Columbus, Iron Eagle 3, Checkered Flag.
I'm loving that.
Like, why didn't he work more after Bond? That's weird.
Well, you know what? Part of that, Matt, might be that the adjusted for inflation lowest grossing movie in the history of the James Bond franchise is
License to Kill. Yeah.
Adjusted for inflation, it made $80 million.
Maybe he just retired.
You think so?
I mean, why not?
The industry retired him.
Well, he would have been 57 when he finished.
Do you think he was like, I'm good. I've got it all done.
It's possible, but I really do like his films. They're not like artful, you know? Like there's nothing all that special about them. They're just kind of in a good way, they're a little hackneyed, you know? Like they're just riding on the tropes that they already invented before his films. And I can't think of anything new that they really bring in any way. But in a way that's comforting. Like his are the most comforting Bond movies to me because they ask nothing of you and take nothing from you.
And
give you everything you need, but nothing more. Nothing too healthy.
In a lot of ways, you know, it's like when you have a franchise that's extended for this long, it's a lot like having a TV show that's up and running, you know?
Yeah,
and you're coming into a family that has been going and making this thing for a long time.
Yeah, so and he had been a part
expected,
of that.
Yeah, and what's expected of you at that point is to come in and let everybody do what they do well. And, you know, if you have any ideas, great. If it fits the mold, then we'll go for it. Otherwise, you know, a good director of television is someone who can, you know, fit into the production, can fit into the system and can and do and execute, you know, what the showrunner wants executed. And to that point, like, your job, I think, at that point, and the point he was doing those James Bond movies was to go in there and execute what Cubby Broccoli wanted.
Right. And I think like the actual praise that should go to him is when he wasn't a director, because he was doing a lot of second unit stuff and editing. Like he did the Moonraker skydiving sequence. He did the editing for On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which was like revolutionary. And I'm sure a lot of that was coming from Peter Hunt's direction, but still, I actually think his best time was before he was a director, and he had been with the franchise for so long.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, John, you're great, and don't if you happen to download this podcast before your next flight, just know that we love you.
That's right, and in the tradition of Desmond Llewellyn's hands, John Glenn has the longest teeth you will ever see.
That's right. John Glenn's teeth are a Moonraker plus or minus. All right. So that's John Glenn. Anything else you care to say about Mr. John Glenn?
No, other than I love his work with the Apollo program.
Okay. Well, here's the deal. John Glenn never flew on the Apollo. He was a Gemini and Mercury astronaut. Okay.
Oh, no.
He flew on the space shuttle also.
You mistake me. I'm talking about how he used to head the Apollo fan club for Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, this John Glenn. Yeah. Now I know.
There's a third John Glenn. Yeah.
Okay. So then I guess, Matt, we're talking about Mark Forrester.
You've done it again. It's Mark Forrester.
Forrester. Forrester. Forrester. Yeah.
But now he's the toughest one, because I think that's why this film is so doggone frustrating, because of the writer strike, and more information is, I feel like, coming out over time that he and Daniel Craig really had to work together to make this thing, and he didn't get the editing. I would love a world where we got to see the intended Quantum of Solace, because there's some great stuff in this movie, visually, frenetically. Sometimes it's a little too confusing. The acting is really good. I actually like the tone. Some people think it's too serious, but I'd really, really, really love to see a director's cut of this film. Do you think we'll ever get that? God, I want it.
No, no, I want it. Never. It will never, ever, ever happen.
You don't think?
No. No. Why? The James Bond franchise is not a big BTS friendly situation. You know what I mean?
But they keep everything close to the vest with special features. But I feel like this one deserves it, and they might someday recognize that, because first of all, they'd make a ton of money, I'd think.
I don't know how many people are out there clamoring now, listening, you know, to this podcast, when this becomes, and you and I aside.
When this becomes the next on Her Majesty's Secret Service in about 15 years, 20 years, I think this will happen. God, I hope I live to see the day. Like a 4-hour cut of this movie.
Well, Matt, what I love about this movie, it is beautiful. It is a beautiful movie.
Right.
There are so many shots in this movie that are just gorgeous.
Yeah.
The framing's beautiful. The color is beautiful. The absence of color. You know, you're going over, you know, it's got fire, it's got water, it's got desert. It's really spectacular. I mean, that opera scene is amazing looking.
Yeah, he also brings interesting touches we've never seen before, like the scene descriptions, like when you go to different places that are kind of like the font is integrated into the composition. And I'm really looking forward to watching this movie again. I've been holding up. I've been wanting to watch it, but I keep thinking, I shouldn't watch it now because I'll be watching it soon enough.
Yeah, and I mean, the rooftop chase scene in this movie is fantastic. The cold open of this movie is up there for me as one of the best cold opens ever, as you can go back and listen to on our cold open ranking. Cold openings, hot rankings.
That was a fun episode.
Most popular episode of all time.
Of any podcast ever.
Yeah, pretty much. So I just cannot get over how... I mean, this movie so hinges on watching it within a very close distance to Casino Royale for it to really fully take its form.
Yeah. I once saw him speak at USC. They did a kind of Bond day where they showed On Her Majesty's Secret Service on the big screen, which, by the way, is so good to see on the big screen. Mm-hmm. And it was him and Tom Mankiewicz and... I think Barbara Broccoli.
My God.
Yeah. I wanted to say maybe even Olga Kurylenko, because I think she and Mark Forster were dating at the time. But there's just something about when he talks about the film, you can tell he was really invested in it and he really cared. And that's why I'm so bummed that the circumstances were what they were, because he wasn't just a jobber coming in. He seemed like he wanted to make a good film. You know, like Martin Campbell did and Sam Mendes.
Yeah, I mean, Vision, again, I have to say, this is up there with your Skyfalls, as far for me as pure, like, beautiful James Bond movies.
Yeah.
So, Mark Forster, you are incredible. I wish you got to do more than the one movie.
I'm tempted to put him higher on my list, but because it's only one movie, I feel like...
I know, that's where you suffer. I think maybe we should talk about ranking people, ranking the 5 one-timers in a separate sort of situation. Maybe right after we get to the end of this, we'll just pop back and go boom, 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 boom.
That's a good idea.
So that being said, Matt.
Yes.
That was 8 and 7, right?
Right.
So it's time to talk about number 6. Yes, that was 8 and 7. Number 6 on the list for me is Roger Spottiswoode.
That high, huh?
Yeah.
Are you doing that?
No, I'm not.
As it's
I'm
a
not.
Protest
I really
ranking?
I genuinely like. I like that movie so much.
I know you like the movie.
I don't do it like to make light of our friendly disagreement over the film.
Uh-huh.
I do it because I think he pulled the best performance out of Pierce Brosnan.
Hmm.
Of anybody. I really do. And I will take that to my grave. I know you have your problems with the film. I know that you generally don't care for a single second of that movie.
I think that's
but,
fair.
But I do genuinely. I enjoy it. And I think that for me, for my money, again, going back to the whole John Glenn of it all and being someone who can deliver a James Bond formula and a James Bond look, and I think that Roger did as good a job as he could, given the material.
Okay. I'll let you have the last word on that.
You had no word on it. I love it.
I think people know where I stand. I just feel like the tone is so all over the place, and it cancels out the good and the bad.
I think that the tone... Well, for me, I don't find the tone to be all over the place. I find it to be very tonally James Bond. But that, again, we've had this discussion many times, and I'm sure we'll have it many more times. We're going to be old. We're going to be decrepit. We're going to be in a home in North Hollywood for former podcasters.
That's right, we will.
And we're going to look at each other.
One of us will have a deathbed conversion. Or whoever outlives the other will go... On his deathbed, he relented.
Matt was right. It wasn't good. Boy, that would be fun. A old home for podcasters.
We'll be there watching the director's cut of Quantum of Solace.
Let's write that TV show.
Oh, God. Home for podcasters.
Yeah, it's just, we're sitting there talking. We're talking, constantly talking. No one's recording it, but we're talking.
That would be great.
All right, so Matt, who is next on your list?
My number six is Lewis Gilbert.
Nailed it. You nailed
director
it.
Director of You Only Live Twice, Moonwaker, and The Spy Who Loved Me.
Here's my question, Matt.
Yeah.
Why? Lewis Gilbert, I feel like, is higher than he should be here. When you look at the true body of work, and you look at a film like You Only Live Twice, which is all right. The Spy Who Loved Me, which is the best of the Brosnans. I mean, not the Brosnans, the Moores, the Roger Moore movies, widely accepted as such. And then you have Moonraker. So for me, I'm looking at like Moonraker and You Only Live Twice being on the same list here. And I'm like, okay. And then The Spy Who Loved Me in the middle. I feel like this drags him down.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think I struggled with putting Mark Forster above him. But again, Mark Forster's only got one film. And then again, Lewis Gilbert's basically only got one film because they're all the same. But yeah. I mean, he did bring something that the prior films didn't have, and that was pushing it to its limit that hadn't been done yet. And I think there's something to be said for that, especially in Bond. And I also think like in Moonraker, there's some and You Only Live Twice. Especially, there's some really great stuff in there, some great shots. Like some of the cinematography in Moonraker is quite good. And I don't know,
they're
his
big
films
too.
Think
about this, think about the coverage he had to get too. He did Volcano Lair,
right?
Tanker Ship with Two Submarines,
yeah,
and Moonraker,
right? That's right,
huge, huge James Bond movies,
yeah. It's worth mentioning, too, that cold opening of Spy Who Loved Me was another John Glenn joint.
Oh, right. The
famous
Union Jack parachute scene.
Yeah. But also, I just love the sweet little man in his interviews when he's got his Oxford shirt buttoned all the way to the top and his little sweet speech impediment. I don't know. Lewis Gilbert. What else did he direct? He's actually had a career.
Suck it, everyone else. Lewis Gilbert.
Lewis Gilbert. Alfie. He did Alfie.
Oh. What's it all about?
Educating Rita.
Oh.
Shirley Valentine. Boy, he's done a lot.
Still with us, by the way.
No kidding.
No kidding.
How old is
he? Man is still going. Born in 1920. He's nearly 100. He's 98 years old.
Look at all the pictures on his IMDb are him in the blue
all button
shirt,
to the top.
Button to the top. He's just so sweet looking.
Hello. Hello, Matt.
I'm hunting Wabbit.
Matt, thank you for liking my movie. You see, inside of this boat, we have many tiny submarines, but they're big submarines.
They're not miniature submarines. They're real sized.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. He really... Talk about a career. This guy has been around and has directed almost... I mean, the last thing he directed was in 2002.
What was it?
It was a movie called Before You Go. The imperfect lives of three sisters are revealed at their unloved mother's funeral. Julie Walters, John Hannah, Tom Wilkinson.
Huh.
You know, decent cast.
Yeah.
So, Lewis Gilbert. I'm going to pop over to the box office mojos of Lewis Gilbertisms. You Only Live Twice, Matt, is the number four.
Okay.
Adjusted for inflation, domestic gross in the United States, that is $329 million adjusted for inflation. Spy Who Loved Me is number 16. And Moonraker is number 5. So he's got 4 and 5 on the list.
Pretty good.
Pretty good, Lewis Gilbert. All right. That brings us to... Number 5.
The top 5.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Here we are. We're in the top 5. And number 5 for me. Buckle up, Mr. Matt Gourley.
Uh-huh.
This is the 5 and 4 for me were flip-flopperinos, okay?
Okay.
Just have to say. And this is what I've landed on.
Okay.
Number 5 for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sam Mendes.
Me too.
Whoa!
Yep.
This is unbelievable.
That's right. He's an interesting fella because I think Skyfall, his work on that is truly great, really remarkable. And then Spectre really knocks his average down quite a bit.
Yes. It's interesting. Here's my question to that point of Spectre. And we'll obviously address this again when we do our third episode about Spectre.
And when the director's cut comes out.
You love a director's cut.
I love it.
My question is, how much of the bad things of Spectre are on Sam Mendes?
Yeah, you're right, because the script.
Yeah.
It's how a similar thing this... to Mark Forster.
Right. But I mean, the job Mark Forster did, given what he was given,
yeah,
with the timing of everything. But here's my question on this. Spectre. Let's talk about it a little bit right now about the things we don't like about Spectre, right?
Yeah.
I think the main thing that we both are not huge fans of is the trying to tie in together all the Daniel Craig movies at the end of this film.
Yeah.
That is a huge that hugely knocks it down in my estimation.
And the brother thing.
Yeah, the brother thing. God, I always forget about that.
It's funny how those two things didn't bother me the first time I saw it. And I was very aware that they bothered a lot of people right out of the gate, but I for some reason was just like, "No, that seems okay." And then
it only took
a second viewing, I think.
It was because we had so many expectations going into the movie. And our expectations, like everything we wanted out of the movie, it gave us. But on top of those things, it gave us horrible things. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like we wanted him to be on a mission. We wanted him to do this, that, and the other thing. They ticked off all those boxes.
Yeah.
But in addition to ticking off those boxes, they decided to do this weird shared universe thing where all the movies were connected. Then they decided to do the brother orphan thing, which was unnecessary. And on top of that, the whole thing with like the Spectre over the quantum situation, like trying to wrap that into there. It was a tall order. He did give us a lot of stuff, and he also gave us some beautiful visuals in that movie. Now, he's so high on the list, though, for me, because of Skyfall.
Right.
And just what he was able to accomplish with Skyfall.
Yeah, so that is a good question. I wonder, I mean, it's obvious there were script problems on Spectre, and that they were really went through a lot of versions, and they were rushed, and they, I think, were clamoring to get that third act done as the film was ramping up to shoot or even shooting.
Yeah.
Where Skyfall, they really got to develop. But also, wasn't Spectre delayed and Sam Mendes wasn't going to do it? And then they decided to wait for him. So you would have think they would have had a little bit more to offer there script-wise.
But whose idea was it, though, is my question. Whose idea was the connecting them? You know what I mean?
Well, I feel like I could be wrong about this, but because Purvis and Wade weren't originally on that, was it the John Logan draft? Was he who did it, I think? Or Peter Morgan? Why do I get those two mixed up? But he did the first draft.
We're never going to be able to figure out. This is the great mystery of our James Bond fandom.
I know. But they weren't even on this one at all. And then they were brought on later, and I feel like they added the third act.
Hmm.
But maybe it was always intended for them to tie the things together. I don't know.
Why do we not know anyone? I guess because it happens mostly across the pond. But it's like, I find it weird that we don't know tangentially anybody in these movies or dealing with this production-wise.
Yeah.
I'm going to start poking around Sony.
You should.
You're like, hey, I've seen, you know, I walk by some offices, I see some Spectre and Skyfall posters, so maybe I'll just knock over there and be like, hey, question.
Yeah. And I know the script was leaked, the early draft version, but I wonder if there's more than one version out where you could start to compare the iterations of it. I don't know. But they're working on the next one.
Purvis and Wade.
Yeah. Solely, right?
Yeah, as far as I know. So this
will be interesting to see, because this will be the first Daniel Craig where they go solo, I think.
Yeah.
For it was now. Paul Haggis on the first two. Then what? Let me see who
was Logan on Logan. Skyfall.
Okay, and Spectre. Right?
And then I believe Logan on Spectre as well.
Logan went solo on Spectre, and that's when they needed to bring.
And then
him
they
in.
Brought in Purvis and Wade. Yeah. Spectre, by the way, Matt.
Yeah.
Number 14 on the adjusted for inflation.
Wow.
Skyfall is number 3.
Okay.
So I'm just hoping you're enjoying that. By the way, worldwide, Spectre is number 2. Skyfall is number 1.
Okay. Wow.
All right. Just so you have that in your head.
Okay.
Skyfall, of course, made $1.1 billion.
Jesus.
And Spectre made $880 million.
Skyfall is a billionaire.
It is. And domestic gross is 27.5% of Skyfall's take came from the domestic box office.
Wow.
There you go.
All right. Number four
with a bullet is Mr. Guy Hamilton.
Me too, Matt.
What? This might be our closest list ever.
Yeah, that's true.
Tomorrow Never Dies Again, throwing everything off.
Yeah, it always does.
Okay, so here's the deal with Guy Hamilton. He gave us essentially the future template for all James Bond movies, which is Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
But then he followed it up with Diamonds Are Forever. Not a great film. Then he came back up and was like, here's Live and Let Die. And then he did The Man with the Golden Gun, which is boring.
Right. Yeah.
And I think for me, and tell me if I'm wrong here, I feel like since we ranked him similarly, we probably have similar thoughts on it, but Goldfinger and Live and Let Die coming out of the same person. That's a hoot.
That's pretty good. I would say he's the most, his films are probably pound for pound the most fun of any director, if not always great. You know what I mean? Like he's he's established so many things in this franchise, not only like just plot devices and tropes and stuff, but tone and style. I mean, he was the first to really kind of goof off with it a bit.
Yeah.
And so they, for the fun ones, like he, even though he did Goldfinger, to me, he's always a Roger Moore type director. Like, I think that's where he wanted to be in that mode.
Well, he does sort of get the...
Because Diamonds Are Forever is a Roger Moore film, no matter how you slice it.
It's 100% a Roger Moore film. What would he have been like in that?
I think it's easy to imagine. I agree. It should have been his first.
But, you know, if you're a director and you have Goldfinger under your belt and we're ranking James Bond movies, I mean, quite frankly, how do you...
I know.
How do you not give this guy a top five spot?
That's right. I could also imagine Connery in Live and Let Die pretty easily, actually.
That's interesting. Live and Let Die is the most 70s of his wardrobe.
Oh, I love it, though. It's so good. That light blue denim getup when he walks around Jamaica with Rosie. His turtleneck, black turtleneck.
Yes.
Stealth outfit.
Which was so good that they threw Daniel Craig in it for Spectre. Yeah.
And did you see the new trailer for Mission Impossible? He's in something very similar.
Oh. Well, it's all, I guess, a nod to...
Yeah.
You know. Goldfinger, Matt, domestic box office. It is the number two James Bond film. $608 million domestically. Now, Goldfinger worldwide does not crack the top 10.
Wow.
And that's unadjusted. This is unadjusted worldwide box office.
Okay.
So, pretty interesting. $608 million adjusted for inflation. Unadjusted gross, $51 million.
Wow.
Released December 22nd, 1964.
What December 22nd? Wow.
December 22nd.
Interesting.
I mean, I always think of James Bond movies as November, December, don't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, this some of the summer ones, License to Kill, Living Daylights, View to a Kill, Dr. No, For Your Eyes Only, Live and Let Die, Spy Who Loved Me, From Rush with Love, Moonraker, and You Only Live Twice were all summer releases. Everything else was November, December. All right. Anything else to say about Guy?
No. Well, he also directed a fair amount of films that I actually do like.
Now my wife is blow drying her hair without the door closed.
She's a podcaster, shouldn't she?
I know. I know. It's crazy. Honey. Dory. She obviously can't hear me over the amazing amount of noise that's being made.
Well,
again, apologize to our listeners at home.
I can't really hear it that bad. It's not too bad.
All right. Well,
so let me just run through a couple of films that he's directed. They're all sort of in his trademark style. Funeral in Berlin, which is one of the Harry Palmer trilogy, the Michael Caine, Ipcress File movies. That's, I think, the second one. Battle of Britain. Force 10 from Navarone, which is one of my favorite films of all time. God, I love that movie. I don't think it's a great movie, but it's just one of those World War II movies that, you know, they lose a man as they go along the whole mission every 10 minutes and keep on going.
I've never seen it, Matt.
Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins. What a classic.
Cool. You were just going through Guy Hamilton's list. After Force 10 and Navarone, I believe you were talking about...
Remo Williams.
Yes, that's exactly it, Matt.
Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins, where it's basically kind of a James Bond movie itself. Have you ever seen
what
that?
What if Wilford Brimley was in a James Bond movie?
And Joel Grey as an Asian person.
And Fred Ward, who I wrote into a pilot not long ago.
Oh, really?
I love him. I love Fred Ward.
Yeah, I do too. He showed up in season two of True Detective. He didn't have much to do, but it was really nice to see him.
Very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Very, very character actor, badass kind of guy.
Yeah, he's great.
So, Guy Hamilton, we salute you.
Yep. All right. Who's your number three, Matt? I'm wondering if we're going to go...
Do you think we'll run out the list together?
I think our top five might be exactly the same.
This is going to be an interesting discussion. Okay.
Yeah.
Matt.
Yeah.
My number three.
Uh-huh.
Peter Hunt.
Oh.
Oh, this is no. Where we went awry.
Yep. Mine is Terrence Young.
Oh, well, we're going to not be able to talk about Terrence Young until right now, because my number two is Terrence Young.
I'm looking at his IMDb. Man, he worked up until 1988.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
so this is the man that started it all.
He started it all, and he made Dr. No. I mean, you can't not give him credit where credit's due. He made Dr. No, and then he came back and made From Russia with Love.
And Thunderball.
Which, you know, well I mean, let's not jump into it. I mean, come on.
But all accounts were, every documentary you see on this, everybody always says, you know, he was very much James Bond himself.
Yes.
They always say that about him.
They always say about him, because the man enjoyed dressing well and just being an all-around cool dude.
Eating well, drinking well. He sent Connery to his tailor before he had the job, right? Told him to sleep in the suit.
It's amazing. He got much out of this. And by the way, he's a hands-on director, Matt. And yeah. I'm going to prove that to you by sending you this photo.
He was born in Shanghai.
Wow.
You sent me something?
I did. I sent you a photo of him directing.
Okay.
Because it's delightful.
Oh, yeah. He's got his hands on Tatiana in the bedroom scene in From Russia with Love. But look at him. He's in this beautiful houndstooth type coat and a suit and tie. I wonder. Wow. Yeah, his films, you know, obviously not just because they started it all, but they do have a like a class to them that maybe some of the others don't quite. You know what I mean? Where the rest are like, we know, yeah, we have to have class. It feels like his don't need to fake it, that they kind of are classy, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of what he established, you know, we talk about Guy Hamilton establishing the formula with Goldfinger, but I mean, just think of how iconic the shot is of Sean Connery's first words on the screen.
Right.
You know, yeah, just to frame that up with the...
That's amazing.
Talking to the lady in red, and you're in a smoky casino, and he looks up and lights, yeah, a cigarette. I mean, just ready to go from that point on.
Right. Right.
And for me, I, you know, From Russia with Love is... close to a perfect James Bond movie.
Well, we'll find out next week when we rewatch From Russia with Love.
What a treat.
Right.
For everyone listening at home, that episode might be a little bit late. Depends on where our schedule falls on Monday.
Oh,
just,
yeah,
prepping people just in case.
Okay. All right. I don't have a ton, yeah, to say about Terrence Young, surprisingly. I think just because his is really the gold standard. Like, he set the tone completely, and it was just a matter of where do you deviate from that,
right? Well, he also has the number one grossing James Bond film of all time, adjusted for inflation, Matt.
Thunderball?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Thunderball.
Wow.
Okay. Unbelievable. Okay. It is time to talk about
Peter Hunt.
Peter Hunt.
Yep.
Your number two, correct?
He's my number two, and he only did one film, but he did the editing on all the films prior, or I think most of them, if not all of them.
Yeah.
But the way he pushed the envelope that would, I think, wasn't appreciated at the time, and really wasn't until you got to Casino Royale or even Quantum of Solace, that the Bourne movies. Like, he was doing some shit that you just didn't see, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that.
He was the most innovative director.
Yeah, maybe so.
You know, of that period too, and you know,
of any of them,
these
I
movies,
think.
And you know, they let him do a lot. They gave him a lot of freedom, and I think because of that, they were paid back with a movie that's great. And I just, you know, it's hard to say where it stands in the pantheon of James Bond movies. It's just, I think it's ruined. Rather, the legacy of it's ruined by the fact, or maybe helped by the fact, that George Lazenby only did one. He was one and done.
Yeah, they did give him total freedom, but I feel like if I'm remembering it correctly, they weren't entirely happy with it, because, you know, they went the other direction with Guy Hamilton after this. So I don't think he was asked back, and I don't think they appreciated what he had done. But what's interesting, mm-hmm. too, is how innovative he was and how realistically he pushed it, however, how much he adhered to the original novel more than any Bond film to date, I think.
Yeah, I wish he'd gotten more work after this movie.
Oh yeah, what did he do?
You know, some TV. He did a Gulliver's Travels, but nothing else.
Huh, let me see.
Nothing really, yeah.
The Persuaders. He did sure. the Ipcress file. Oh, these are editors. Hold on, as an editor, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, wow, yeah. Wild Geese 2, oh boy. Yeah. Oh, man, the original Wild Geese, now that's a movie. Do you ever want a good day? Sit down and watch Force 10 from Navarone into Wild Geese, and you're going to get a Guy Hamilton movie, you're going to get a Roger Moore movie, and you're going to get a lot of just good junk food action dated movies.
Here's his quote regarding James Bond films, which he likened to paperback novels. My feeling was that one should make the films seriously, but never take them seriously.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's good advice.
I love it.
Speaking of taking things seriously, it's time for our number one James Bond director. He hails from the island nation of New Zealand.
Wait, before you go ahead, it's also worth mentioning, I think, that Peter Hunt was the first gay director of a Bond movie, too.
I didn't even know he was.
Yeah, I believe he is. Well, he's dead now. He died in 2002. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe he was. I don't know that he was out, but I think it was common knowledge possibly on the set, too.
Well, fucking innovating in more ways than one, Peter.
That's right.
Just also the best editor they ever had, honestly. The fucking yeah. The cuts in the train fight.
Yeah.
With you know, those two dum-dums. Anyway, Peter Hunt, well done, sir. You did one movie and catapulted yourself to number two on the list. You beat out nine other men.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Are you ready
to talk about
big your best surprise on the planet?
Yeah.
Martin Campbell. Ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Hastings, New Zealand, in October of 1943, it's Martin Campbell, the director of such films as The Mask of Zorro and the Green Lantern movie. We have a man who did two terrific James Bond movies.
That's right. Just watched
Legend of Zorro, not The Mask of Zorro. Legend of Zorro. Oh, he did Mask, too. He did Mask and Legend. Oh, my God.
I just watched The Foreigner.
Oh, how was it? I haven't seen it yet.
I liked it. I thought it was pretty good. maybe it falls apart a little in the end, but it was kind of fun. I think when people are disappointed in it, maybe it might be the marketing, or they're expecting more of a classic Jackie Chan. Yeah. Brosnan's pretty interesting in it too. It's funny because I was looking at some of the reviews and they're talking about how bad his accent is, but he is playing an Irishman and he's Irish. So I don't know what the hell they think they're talking about there, you know. But
maybe
it's worth a watch.
Really heard
I think.
Him. Maybe they've never heard him be Irish. Maybe they spent.
He's also playing a Northern Ireland Irish person too, which they have a little bit of a different.
If you're a listener of this podcast and you are familiar with the accent he used in The Foreigner, I haven't seen it yet. Tell us. Do you think it was good? Do you think it was bad? Are you from? If he is doing a Northern Irish accent, are you from there? Did it sound terrible to you? Let me know.
Yes.
Tweet us.
So,
but yeah.
Casino Royale. I mean, GoldenEye, great film. But what I'm really here for is Casino Royale. And I think the thing I love about Martin Campbell is how he manages to somehow totally deliver what a Bond movie should be. Gracefully, mm-hmm. elegantly, but you're also not really paying attention to the directing. You know, he's
totally
he's not, it's not like a super artistic film, although there's a lot of artistic moments, especially in Casino Royale, and tender moments and good cinematic moments. But I think his real talent is you just get engrossed in the film. You're not watching it, you're in
right.
it, you know, and that movie more than any Bond movie just makes me forget I'm watching a movie and I just get sucked into it. And I love that.
I mean, the direction in that movie is evident everywhere. Everywhere. The
competency and yet you're not,
that movie
but you're not like heavily conscious of it when you're watching it. That's what's so great about it.
No, you
it.
Are. Well, I think you are. I think whenever
really?
You can fully suspend disbelief and enjoy a film, I think then, well, for well, me, my brain
but that by definition,
fully aware.
Really, but that by definition is suspending disbelief is when you aren't thinking that, you know? You
yeah,
just
and I
like,
think but that I think that's what makes a good director is when
oh,
you're
I
not
agree.
Thinking about it.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just like macro and you're micro.
But as we sit here and talk about it, you can think about it. But I feel like when I'm watching that movie, it just gets me in every time and that's what I love about it. And then it's only later when I go, holy shit, that was artful and seamless and masterful how he directs and how he gets you through scenes without even thinking about it, you know?
I think what he does well, Martin Campbell, is make... I just twirled my glasses out of my hands.
I saw that.
It's ridiculous. What he does really well is direct action.
Yeah.
He, man, I mean, even thinking back to, yes, the parkour stuff at the beginning is fantastic, but like, think about the stairway fight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Think about the whole, I mean, we always forget every time we talk about this movie, we end up talking about the scene at the airport, that chase, but we're always like, I never think about that movie. When I think about the movie.
Yeah,
I never think about that scene. And when you think about that scene, it's an amazing scene. But it's between so much
right.
great action that you just like, you're like, oh yeah, that was in that movie.
And not only that, but like that first scene between Vesper and Bond on the train, just moments where, and I don't know if this is Ava Green or Martin Campbell, but the way she enters and she just like storms in, plops down, throws her purse down and just goes, mm-hmm. I'm the money. Anyone else would have probably just walked in normally or something. Like I don't know. There's just a specialness to it that is not over the top or flashy, but very memorable. So good.
Yeah. It's endlessly. It's an endlessly rewatchable movie.
Yeah.
And I haven't. Again, this is another one that I haven't watched since we last talked about it.
I've seen this one not too long ago, just because I love to have it on.
What
here's a question.
Yeah.
We've talked about who we would like to direct the next Bond movie. You know, it would be amazing if they would bring him back for Craig's last Bond movie.
Oh my God.
I wonder if they've considered it. I mean, he's
so good.
I feel like he would do it. Yeah. Because I keep thinking like, oh, Denis Villeneuve or, you know, one of these new fancy directors. But why not just go back to the guy who's gotten it done?
Here's what I say. I don't think you need a fancy director for a James Bond movie. I don't think you're looking for that. You know what I mean? I don't think you're looking for these twists on the formula. I think you're looking for a competent action director.
It's a tough one because you need more than just a blockbuster director. You do need someone who like Terrence Young has taste and style and can incorporate in these action movies seamlessly so that the two go together. And that, as it is evidenced by a lot of these movies, is not easy to do.
Yeah.
And that's what you truly need. Yeah.
So Martin Campbell, you have our vote for Bond.
Please come back. Please come back.
I wish we could just call Barbara Broccoli.
I know.
Just be like, hey, Babs, we got some ideas.
You know, us.
These two that do this unauthorized podcast about James Bond. So that's our list, everybody. Those are our top 10 directors, top 11 directors. I hope you guys agree with us. If you don't agree with us, tell us in the comments. Don't forget to subscribe. Well, I'm just slipping into a YouTube video.
Yeah, no kidding. Wait, before we wrap up Martin Campbell, I do find it interesting that he's both of our number one pick, but the rest of his resume isn't anything spectacular. If anything, it's kind of the opposite. I mean, I think Zorro's pretty well regarded, but Green Lantern...
Well, you know what? You know what it is, though? I think maybe that's it's the material. You can be good... Like, something can... You can thread the needle on something so well. You could be really great at X. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, I'm like,
it's obviously his wheelhouse to do this kind of Bond
for
film.
Sure. And it's like, you know, I could be, you know, I'm a competent writer, but I'm really good at writing jokes on the Goldbergs. You know what I mean? It's like that.
Yeah.
It's like that's there's a wheelhouse for people. And I think his wheelhouse is the James Bond mix of action and drama.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because, like, Green Lantern doesn't, tonally is not that.
No, I've never seen it, but I've seen a bit of it.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right,
Campbell,
so
we love you. And now it's time, everybody, for the number one, for the people who've directed, there's five people who've directed one film only.
And that's Lee Tamahari, Roger Spottiswoode, Michael Apted, Mark Forster, and Peter Hunt, right?
Yes.
Well, it's going to be
a
surprise. We'll just do them in
like,
this,
it, by the
in
way,
the
it almost sounds like
order.
That's the exact order.
Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to sign off on that order. I'm going to sign off on that order, man.
Pretty easy.
Well done, everybody. We will see you all next week for From Russia with Love. Oh, I didn't do that right. We usually say James Bonding will return. I'll start it. James Bonding
will return in From Russia
podcast
with Love.
James Bond. James Bonding podcast. James Bonding podcast. James Bonding podcast. James Bonding podcast.
Hey, this is Arnie Niekamp from the Improv Fantasy Podcast, Hello from the Magic Tavern. I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King in Chicago into the magical land of Foon, and I started a podcast. Season 3 has just begun with a brand new adventure to defeat the Dark Lord. If you're a new listener or you've fallen behind, Season 3 is a great jumping on point. And we've got great guests like Justin McElroy.
I sound like a fancy college professor. 8 knots.
Rachel Bloom.
You all see my collection of men corpses and one woman.
Felicia Day and Colton Dunn.
You've seen me have intercourse with a variety of species.
It's a bummer.
Andy Daly.
You have the members of Genesis listed, but Phil Collins has crossed out and then circled and crossed out again.
Yes, I have killed Phil Collins twice.
Thomas Middleditch.
Jesus! I mean, Jazos! Ruler of the Eighth Circle!
And that's just the beginning. Season 3 of Hello from the Magic Tavern is out now. Listen in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.